Okay, so I cannot pretend that my paper is going to tie together the many interesting thematic strands that have been raised by the other three presenters, but I am going to talk about the Global South, I am going to talk about political struggle, and I am going to talk about the state. So hopefully we'll find a few common threads in there. My paper is called Cold War Archives and Democratic Aspirations in Latin America, and as many of you know, the so-called Cold War was anything but cold in Latin America. The second half of the 20th century, as Gabriel Garcia Marquez once observed, was a period of turmoil and horror so intense, featuring dictatorships, counterinsurgency wars, refugee crises, and genocide, that it constituted what the writer called an outsized reality. So as the Cold War's authoritarian regimes in Latin America gave way to at least nominally democratic ones, societies from Mexico all the way down to Argentina grappled with a core question, which was, what and how can we rebuild in the aftermath? And archives help answer that question. If ever it was possible to see archives as epiphenomenal or, you know, extraneous to larger processes of post-conflict transition, that moment has passed and it's now a commonplace that any post-war or post-dictatorship society needs to reckon in some way with the files of its past repressive regimes. So today I'm going to be speaking about the complex politics of opening up Cold War archives, state security archives, for the most part, in Latin America, and how those processes do and do not intersect with what I'm calling democratic aspirations in the region. And I'll be focusing on four main cases: Guatemala, Chile, El Salvador, and Argentina. And what I would like to demonstrate is that even though the main impetus for opening up the files of past repressive regimes in these contexts has been largely legal in nature, driven by the hope of generating evidence to use in war crimes prosecutions, it's actually true that the social value of these kinds of Cold War archives, I think, far exceeds the constraints of the courtroom and the constraints of the juridical imagination. And digital tools and digital platforms have a big role to play in that. So I'll just give a very brief and overly general background for those of you who are not Latin Americanists, but who will doubtless still be aware that the countries of the Americas, almost without exception, lived the global Cold War riven by conflicts over economic redistribution, ideology, entrenched power, and modernity. And, you know, each country's story is, of course, distinct. In Guatemala, the structural racism against the indigenous Maya population that went back centuries, coupled with a very 20th century virulent anti-communism to produce both genocidal scorched earth massacres on the part of the military in the rural indigenous countryside and a campaign of surgical assassinations of political dissidents by the police and the military as well in the capital city. So that's Guatemala's capsule story. The capsule story in El Salvador is that the civil war was much shorter, much more intense, and much more evenly matched. And the FMLN guerrilla movement came quite close to overthrowing the government, even though that government had extensive assistance from the United States and made recourse to extensive massacres of civilians. In Chile, the democratically elected President Salvador Allende had pursued a constitutional path towards socialism before being overthrown on September 11, 1973 by General Augusto Pinochet, who instituted a 17-year-long dictatorship that relied less on killings in a massive sense, although there were several thousand state-sponsored executions, but rather more on torture and forced exile as tools to dismantle the previously existing Allende coalition and, in fact, all oppositional sectors. So that's the Chile story. In Argentina, a military junta killed and disappeared as many as 30,000 citizens. So there's a lot of differences, and I teach a whole course on these four countries and their dirty war experiences, and so I'm doing a great violence to their histories by summing them up so rapidly. But nevertheless, you know, we can point to some common elements that tie these four countries' experiences during the Cold War together, namely anti-communist military rule, systematic state-sponsored crimes against humanity, more sporadic rights violations by armed insurgent groups, obviously a deep imbrication in larger Cold War geopolitics, and then an end to hostilities roughly by the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. more or less. And in each of these four cases, archives were a key technology of state terror, as intelligence agencies sought to beef up their surveillance apparatuses, their record-keeping capacity, with the help of the United States in order to better track and control enemies of the state. And the sort of best illustration of this is the fact that in Guatemala, the high-level military intelligence unit, whose official name was the Estado Mayor Presidencial, was popularly known to regular Guatemalans during these years as El Archivo, the archive, right? Yet, as the archivist Eric Ketelar notes, quote, if the fact of oppression appears in records originally inscribed for surveillance and tyranny, they can also be used for reclaiming human rights and regaining freedom. And so in the Cold War's aftermath, Latin American social movements set about making access to past regimes' archives one of their signal political demands. And there's a whole kind of cascade of cases in which that's been true, beginning in Paraguay in 1992 with the accidental discovery of the so-called terror archives, the records of the Stroessner dictatorship's secret police. Then in 2005 in Guatemala, activists stumbled accidentally upon the massive decaying archives of the country's defunct national police and launched a still ongoing, now quite high-profile effort to rescue those documents from extreme conditions of physical decay and disorganization and also to digitize them. In Brazil in 2009, the Lula administration created this site, Memorias Reveladas, and uploaded a whole bunch of declassified Brazilian military records to that site for public consultation. All through the mid-2000s in Argentina, under the two Kirchner administrations, similarly, there were efforts to open all available security files from the dirty war period. In 2010, in Chile, under Michelle Bachelet, who was herself a survivor of torture under the Pinochet dictatorship, Chile inaugurates in 2010 a new memory museum that contains within it a public archives that is accessible to all, that contains a lot of digital materials where you don't even necessarily need to go to the archives themselves physically to consult them, but they've got extra stuff there. And the point is to kind of build the documentary materials and access to them into the physical architecture of the museum, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a sec. So you could even say that the Americas have seen a kind of archival cascade, right, comparable to what the political scientist Catherine Sinkin calls the justice cascade. And indeed, those two cascades, the justice cascade and the archive cascade, are related. With more documentation of Cold War dictatorships' war crimes have come more trials of perpetrators, even though, as I'll discuss more, those trials have been pretty difficult to secure and comparatively few and far between. So the archival cascade has been driven by a few different factors. One of them is that juridical thrust of post-1970s human rights discourse and practice. But another has been the rise of the notion that citizens should have the right to access the documents that their governments keep about them. This was, of course, not always the case, right? For the vast majority of the period of human history in which rulers have kept written records about the ruled, there has been very little tradition of public access. Nevertheless, the civil rights and decolonization and social justice movements of the 1960s and 1970s included, if kind of obliquely, the demand that communities should be able to write their own histories. We heard a little bit about this in Jeanette's presentation yesterday morning, and that they should be able to access the raw materials, i.e. the documents, that they would need in order to do so. And so this involved, on the one hand, fostering activist practices of self-documentation, right, kind of spreading awareness about the importance of having social justice organizations keep records of their own activities, but more importantly, involved activist groups and social movements staking claims to records produced by powerful institutions, like militaries, like churches, and like governments. And in the early to mid-1980s, the Argentine human rights activist Adolfo Pérez Esquivel pioneered this new kind of quasi-legal, well, in the common law system, it's quasi-legal. It's actually quite legal under civil law. Concept called habeas data, right? So we've got habeas corpus, show me the body. And now you've got habeas data. Show me the data. So it's a kind of informational analog to habeas corpus that holds that an individual should have the right to access any information about herself or about her family members that is in the possession of her government. And the idea of habeas data has now taken on some new connotations related to privacy in the digital age, but the original genesis of that concept was as a tool of citizen redress under dictatorships that practiced the terror tactic of forced disappearance. Habeas data has now been adopted as a constitutional recourse, a writ of amparo, in Brazil, Paraguay, Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and Argentina. And habeas data is just one example of a variety of different legal and quasi-legal initiatives emerging from the ashes of the Cold War, many of them kind of overseen or stewarded by the United Nations and the International Council on Archives, to standardize and globalize understandings of the relationship between archives on the one hand and the fostering of democratic practices on the other, as various countries go through different iterations of transitional justice processes. Okay, transitional justice. So the idea of transitional justice, you know, seeks to create two fundamental conditions, which are transition and justice. In many of the contexts where transitional justice methodologies have been implemented, though, the transition has been partial at best, and the amount and the extent of the justice that can be achieved usually leaves a lot to be desired. As political transitions are incomplete, so too are archival transitions, usually because when perpetrators are able to remain powerful, they try to keep their files close, right? So in Guatemala, there were several Truth Commission efforts during the 1990s, but they were stonewalled in their efforts to access state records by a nominally civilian set of governments that remained very conservative and allied with the military. So the only releases of records documenting state terror in Guatemala came about via accidental discoveries and leaks. In El Salvador, military and police records remain closed entirely, and the only documents that have appeared, for example, there's a book of detainees, about 1,000 detainees called the Yellow Book, that was discovered by accident in someone's private home. So the files have not been opened, the files have been kept closed with occasional escaped files. In Chile, many of the most high-impact records, for example, records of the DINA, the secret police, remain embargoed or missing. And in Argentina, it took several decades after the fall of the juntas for progressive governments to even try to bring state power to bear on the question of opening the archives. And it's important to note that in the comparatively few cases in which sitting governments have made significant tranches of these kinds of records, past regimes, files, available to citizens or to prosecutors, it has almost never been the result of a kind of democratizing political will from above. Rather, these are victories that are won from below, that owe to the tenacious advocacy of civil society organizations like human rights groups, families of the killed and disappeared, or other minority actors who incur significant political risk by speaking out. So if archives are released at all, it's only after tremendous amounts of pressure, and even then, it tends only to happen quite a long time after the fact, when the possibilities for courtroom justice are greatly diminished, because perpetrators get old and they die, and then the likelihood also increases that high-impact documents can be destroyed, whether willfully, like, oh, we see that, you know, there's starting to be trials, let's get rid of this stuff, or just through neglect, which was the case with the Guatemalan police archives. So if you look at these four cases, we start to see that courtroom use is actually only one of many ways that records documenting state-sponsored violence can contribute to the work of social reconstruction. Much like how trials, and this is an argument that I quite like, made by Laurel Fletcher and a different Harvey Weinstein, political scientist, Harvey Weinstein, trials are just one of many elements necessary to a broader ecology of social repair. And so in this ecological model that Fletcher and Weinstein set out, this sort of individualizing telos of the juridical, right, the idea of the courtroom as being the place where history gets adjudicated, is problematic for a number of different reasons, not least of which that many of its most vaunted benefits don't really have a lot of empirical foundation. We assume that trials, quote unquote, heal wounds. We assume that they build consensus about the past. We assume that they bring closure in post-conflict settings. And in fact, we don't really have any data that that sustains any of those notions. We just kind of want them to be true, and so we repeat them. This is not to say trials are bad. It's just to say that they don't often do the work that we like to think that they do. And so Fletcher and Weinstein argue that collective violence really requires a much wider variety of repertory measures in the aftermath than just trials. And so that can include community-level efforts like building memorials, restitution of property, exhumations and inhumations, unofficial truth-seeking projects, you know, that sort of thing. State-level alternatives to legal intervention, like building museums and this kind of thing, renaming stuff, taking down statues, putting up new statues, psychosocial support, and beyond. And so there's a whole other kind of gamut of ways in which societies can engage in the work of social repair or reconstruction in the aftermath of intense civil violence. And in all of those ways, not just in court, archives have a really important role to play. Museums are a kind of classic example that is probably the sort of most familiar to all of us. Museums deploy documents all the time, whether documents generated by past repressive regimes or documents generated by dissident social movements, to try to leverage what Lisa Gittleman calls the no-show function of written documents, the authority of written documents for maximum persuasive power. Actually, I'm going to return to this one in a sec. I put that one in the wrong place. So this is a shot from the Museo de la Memoria in Santiago de Chile. It's a case in point. Has anyone been to this museum? This is like a big, shiny, fancy, yes, we have one, new glitzy memory museum. And it abounds with archival materials ranging from executive decrees, suspending civil liberties, and abolishing political parties. They've got the passports of supposed subversives bearing the stamps of exile. They've got photos and film clips. They've got underground pamphlets from resistance organizations. They've got letters smuggled out by detainees from prison and concentration camps. The museum, as I mentioned before, also manages much of the extant archival material pertaining to human rights violations from the dictatorship in that documentation center that I showed a picture of before that's physically integrated into the museum itself. And in 2013, at least, which was the last time I looked online at their data for the museum, their annual report, the museum logged more than 50,000 visits from 30,000 distinct visitors. And so by enshrining documents as a part of the public sphere in this kind of a facility, the museum can multiply and democratize their potential impact. And the same is true of other kind of more successful memory museums, like the Museum of the Word and the Image in San Salvador, the MUPI, which has similarly kind of tried explicitly to transform itself into a popular archive. They invite the public to donate or loan documents of historical significance so that they can be more widely shared. And they have taken advantage of resources from the pioneers of post-custodial archiving at the University of Texas Austin Library System to, for example, digitize the entire audio archives of Radio Venceremos, which was the FMLN's guerrilla radio station during the war. Now, for archives to be incorporated into public life in this way, they need to be gathered. Obviously, they need to be recuperated. There's a tremendous amount of labor involved. Sometimes they need to be wrested free. And as I've said, often that's only possible through long processes of political struggle between citizen and state, which in the Guatemalan context I've referred to as archive wars. And those processes themselves can be transformative. So it's not just about the content of the documents that you open up and make accessible to the public. It's the fact that in places and times in which justice activists have been able to claim physical and intellectual control over records that were once used against them, it's that act of obliterating this sort of one archival logic of surveillance and repression and social control and replacing it with this new second archival logic of opening and remembering, that work in and of itself can be deeply reparative for the people who are involved in it or who are able to observe it. So the task of rescuing the National Police Archives in Guatemala, which is a project I've worked on for a long time, That obliged a deeply splintered human rights community to come together. It reunited activists who had not seen each other in decades, and it helped build intense and new intergenerational bonds between older generations of militants who had themselves been protagonists in the conflict and new generations of post-war progressives. So that kind of affective labor also contributes to the sort of larger collective project of social repair. That larger collective project involves not just recovering old archives, but also constructing new ones. And those new ones, as we've seen over the course of the last 2 days, don't have to be limited to the written word, the printed page, or kind of conventional archivists' understandings of what is an archives, officially speaking, according to the dictionary definition. One example is the effort by Argentina's grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo, and later the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala and similar groups in El Salvador, to construct libraries of DNA samples gathered from thousands of volunteers. And DNA collection, again, has many different purposes. One of them potentially could be courtroom justice, but that's not the only objective. The main objective, of course, is to reunite families that were torn apart by state violence, whether in the kind of chaos of rural massacres in Guatemala, or whether, say, in Argentina, with the purposeful and systematic adoptions of the infant children of leftist detainees into conservative military families as a way of terminating the seed of subversion. These kinds of reunions that are facilitated by DNA analysis obviously ideally take place between surviving family members, right? That's the dream. But you know, even posthumous reunions between survivors and the remains of their loved ones can be deeply meaningful, can allow families and communities to accompany processes of exhumation and inhumation. It allows them to grieve privately. It allows them to mourn collectively. In Guatemala, forensic anthropologists are working with the rescuers of the National Police Archives to try and identify, by triangulating forensic evidence, documentary evidence from the archives, and eyewitness accounts, trying to identify some of the many human remains that were buried in paupers' graves without identification in Guatemala City's main cemetery. So technology here is enabling new kinds of collaborations in the service of social repair. The internet has only amplified this kind of work, or at least has amplified the potential benefits of this kind of work. Many of you will be familiar with the work of the National Security Archive, which is a US-based nonprofit that has made tens of thousands of declassified US documents available online for Latin American justice movements to use. And obviously, many of these documents have been entered as evidence in trials, both at the national level and in the Inter-American court system. But they've also been used as teaching tools. They've been used in works of art. This is an exhibit that I saw in Chile at the Salvador Allende Foundation Museum by a Chilean artist. And you can see how she's making use of these declassified, redacted US documents in this three-part piece here, this triptych. And in many other ways. So again, to declassify a document or to put it online doesn't mean that you have to engage with it as a reader of text exclusively, right? The document has a kind of broader resonance that can be made use of in different sorts of ways that take us a little further away from the scholarly and closer to the affective. These include ways that are hard for us to quantify, but that we know exist. And the example I always think of, and this can I can take myself back to my out of place slide. I have a friend in Guatemala who talked to me about a personal experience that he had had. He's a young guy, a couple years younger than me, and his parents were both militants in the Guatemalan Communist Party who had lost many comrades as a result. And my friend was remembering when this document, this is one page of a 200-page document called the Diario Militar, which was smuggled out of Guatemala's army's archives in the late 1990s and put online. Anyone can download this document, and it chronicles the detentions and mostly the killings, in one or two cases, the escapes or the releases, of political activists in and around Guatemala City in 1983 and 84 and 85. And my friend was telling me about how when his mother first found out that she could actually download this document in their house, and so she downloaded it, it's a PDF, and she's reading through it, and she's becoming very upset because she's looking at all of these pictures of people that she had known, and in many cases, these are people who were officially classified as disappeared, but in this document, you know, there are particular cases in which it will say, actually, on this date, the person was killed. But because that information was never made public, the person was sort of officially remembered as having been disappeared. But now you can find out that no, in fact, the person was killed. So that kind of encounter with the document, with the information that's incredibly personal that we would have no way as academics of knowing about unless you were going to go and like survey everybody in Guatemala who'd ever looked at this document, which of course you can't do, that I think needs to be taken into account as well, even if we can't quantify it. So that's another thing that the internet can do. The internet helps groups like the grandmothers, sorry, I'll stay here for a minute, helps groups like the grandmothers and the forensic anthropologists in Guatemala solicit DNA donations, including in diaspora and exile communities in the United States and in Europe. So the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala knows that there are tons of Guatemalans living in Los Angeles, and so they go to Los Angeles and they run around the Guatemalan neighborhoods and they take DNA swabs from people to build into that library. And so the internet facilitates that kind of communication. It allows museums like the MUPI in El Salvador to post a document of the month that people can look at. In a kind of more massive level, it's allowed the team rescuing the Guatemalan police archives to digitize some 20 million documents of its 80 million page corpus and make them freely available online, again, with help from UT Austin. And those are just a few examples. How am I doing on time? 2 minutes. Okay, so then I won't tell the story. What I will do is I will flag for the Q&A the fact that there are some real and very problematic privacy implications for this sort of digitize all the police files and put them on the internet push, but if anyone wants to know about that, I will tell you about it later in the interests of time. But the point being that what you can do now is project outward from this incredibly voluminous archives, most of whose documents are too fragile and too degraded by mold and bugs and infestations of various sorts to be manipulated by hand. This allows anyone anywhere in the world, including students within Guatemala and people, of course, everywhere else, to engage with this archives in a way that they wouldn't be able to do without going to Guatemala City, which most people don't do. So. The internet, it's a great thing. To conclude, I will just say that I think what ties together these diverse applications of archival materials in Cold War Latin America is the importance of having individuals and communities gain or regain the ability to generate and control historical documents in a way that corresponds to their own experiences. So again, this echoes some of the stuff that Jeanette was laying out yesterday morning. And this is not to say that access to the archives is some kind of magical panacea. And you know, obviously the sort of liberal fetishizing of transparency is problematic for all kinds of reasons we can talk about later. But nevertheless, in all these instances, we see examples of people in the Americas marshaling the documentary record from the bottom up, trying to democratize access to the records that document Cold War violence. And in so doing, they have proposed, if implicitly, a kind of more expansive definition of quote-unquote human rights archives that includes not just the bureaucratic residue left behind by perpetrators, but also survivors' testimonies, social movements' own records, truth commission files, DNA samples, and beyond. The sky's really the limit. So while it is true that archives and archival access really became kind of key points of contestation between states and Latin American citizen movements at a particularly demobilizing historical moment, right? One in which the language of human rights came to supplant revolutionary praxis, the imperatives of transitional justice, privileged legal forms of repair over social and economic ones. And like that's all true, and the sort of archival turn is a part of that. But I do think that nevertheless, sort of in spite of that kind of demobilizing reality, social movements have managed to transcend the narrow imagination of the courtroom, rejecting the impunity of a largely neoliberal peace in order to try to make the archives speak. And so I'll leave you with this image and a quote from the Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, who says, "In the history of humankind, every act of destruction meets its response, sooner or later, in an act of creation." And this is a mural painted by some young activist folks outside the Guatemalan Police Archives Recovery Site, which is a police base in a kind of rundown area of Guatemala City. And you can see here Lady Justice, and she's got the traditional scales of justice in her left hand, but in her right hand, instead of the sword, she's carrying a bundle of archival documents, and she's wandering through this sort of array of discarded documents, which behind them have been organized into nice, neat, acid-free archival boxes. And then over on the right, you see there's this sort of germination, there's this shoot of something new that is emerging from the experience of using the kind of justice imperative to return to the archives and try to use them for a different purpose than the purpose for which they were originally intended. That's it. Thanks.